Hello and welcome to episode 13 of a series of podcasts featuring University Registrars talking about stuff. This time I'm talking to Rachel Sandby-Thomas, who's Registrar at the University of Warwick, about a variety of current issues in higher education, many of them COVID-19 related. Rachel fills us in on her extensive and varied career as a lawyer in the civil service before she joined Warwick, and describes how valuable this experience in Whitehall has been in her role, although she denies forcefully that Frances Maud has in any way influenced her leadership style. We discuss the many ways in which the pandemic has impacted on university life, from the novelty of online council meetings to the car parking benefits, surprising, and how the response to the coronavirus has really brought the university community together at Warwick, with staff contributing their expertise and time in response to the crisis. The negative perception of universities in the public eye and in government, and the expectation that significant strings would be attached to any university support package, are also explored. And finally, we look at the possibility of mergers, which are very far from being a silver bullet, as we see, but the likely resurgence of further education and the skills agenda, and the fact that the crisis has overall highlighted the need for a complete rethink of the current higher education model in England. A packed half an hour indeed. Right. Welcome to this latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And this time, it's my immense pleasure to welcome Rachel Sandby-Thomas from the University of Warwick for a conversation. Welcome, Rachel. It would be really helpful to hear from you in the first instance about your kind of career and background and how you ended up as registrar at the University of Warwick.
Yeah. Oh, certainly. So, well, I started life off as a lawyer. Mainly, I had wanted to do English, but my mother told me I'd be hopeless and the only thing I could do would be a teacher, and I'd be far too impatient to be a teacher. So she said, do law instead. So I did. Started off in the city, as most kind of trainees did, but actually got quite bored. And through sheer serendipity, I discovered that the government employed lawyers. So I moved. It was a leap of faith, but actually I completely loved being a lawyer in government. I loved the variety of it. You moved around about every 3 to 4 years. So sometimes I would be doing something really, really specialist, like pharmaceutical legislation, and become quite an expert in something. And then the next job could be something like advising the attorney on anything that was difficult and politically sensitive from any department in Whitehall on EU law. And it also introduced me to human rights law and to devolution, which at that stage, you know, was the Northern Irish, Scottish, Welsh devolution, which was just in. So hugely, hugely varied and hugely challenging, and with very, very nice and supportive colleagues. Having kind of hopped about all sorts of departments, I became Director General for Legal Services in what was then the Department for Business, Enterprise and Regulatory Reform. So it was kind of the successor department to DTI, which was still really what people used to call it. And then it became BIS, Business Innovation and Skills. And I was a Director General there for 8 years. The first 18 months were just DG Legal, but I was also doing lots of things like capability reviews and a lot of board champion roles and that kind of stuff. So very actively involved. And then they kind of said, oh, well, you're quite useful at this kind of stuff. And they were kind of, you know, shrinking the kind of number of DGs. So they said, well, would you like to take on people in comms? So I became DG Legal, People and Comms, and that was during a very interesting, in the inverted commas, meaning of the word, because, of course, it hit under austerity and lots of restructuring and downsizing and redesigning the organisation, which was pretty tough. I kind of prefer me doing it than somebody else. So that's my only kind of consolation. And then trying to build up a kind of a sense of re-engagement. And then after doing that for about 2 years, I said, oh, well, you can do that now. So why don't you turn your hand to policy? But they didn't kind of say turn your hand to policy by giving me a little policy job to kind of bite my, you know, test my teeth or whatever you call it. No, they gave me the greatest, biggest, whoppingest, huge, ginormous policy job, which was the kind of advanced manufacturing sectors, It was skills, which was a huge agenda.
Yeah.
What else did I start off with? I can't remember. It's quite a few of them. Small business as well. And over the years, I had local growth and I had better regulation. And it was just when they were kind of, you know, the large three areas, they kind of had little bonfires had started, which turned into great big fires. So, kind of, you know, it was a real baptism of fires, I should say, but very interesting, very interesting. And so I've done that for about 4 years. So, you know, time to move on, you know, because that's what you do in government terms. But I kind of looked around and I couldn't really see anything else which I thought would be as interesting as what I had been doing. And so I ended up doing a kind of a sidestep to go and set up the Institute for Apprenticeships. And I felt and still do feel very passionately about apprenticeships. So I was all set to do that for at least another 3 years. And then one day I was sitting at home, working from home, and I got a phone call from a lot called Parrot Labour. And they said, oh, we've been given your name, you know, it's highly recommended, which I'm sure they say to everybody. And there's this job up in Warwick. And I went, well, you know, that's all very nice and very flattering. Thank you very much. But, you know, I live in West Sussex. I don't live in Warwick. So, but, you know, tell me more about it. And of course, they thought, oh, well, that sounds a great big juicy job. Yum, yum, yum.
Yes.
Anyway, so they said, well, we'll continue the conversation. And I kind of got off the phone. And I said to my husband, but it's in Warwick. So, you know, there's no way, is there? And he said, oh, I think there might be. And it's very nice up in Warwick. And that was when it began to kind of become a bit real. And then the next bit of the conversation was a conversation with the VC. And we kind of just clicked after about 2 minutes. And I think that's probably when I got hooked. I'm very susceptible.
So when did you actually start in Warwick then?
I started in September 2016, so nearly 4 years, which I find absolutely gobsmacking.
So yeah, so but still relatively recent in other terms. So in terms of your experience, then, you know, across all of these Whitehall departments and in the law, and in coming through the austerity years, I mean, do you feel it was the ideal grounding to be a registrar at a university like Warwick?
So I don't know what kind of an ideal grounding would be, but I think actually all of the experience that I had in those years in government, all of it has been relevant in ways that I never imagined, And of course, I think that what you begin to realise is that everybody does a job differently depending on that experience and where they have come from. So no doubt anybody else who would have been appointed to the job would just have done the job differently because of that different background. So, and of course, I don't even realise in many ways how different it is or how differently I'm kind of doing because I wasn't there before. So the only kind of points of comparison I have are knowing how stuff was done in government and also having seen government change hugely what it did. So funny enough, I used to think, because actually, especially post-austerity, we made a huge amount of change in how government operated. And, you know, the university quite reminds me of how government used to operate. So I kind of often think to myself, so how did we bring about that change so quickly? And then I kind of think there's probably Francis Maude. So there's some lessons to be learned and some lessons not to be learned, I think.
So I won't ask who might be the Francis Maude in the university, but I mean, what I think you're suggesting is that, you know, you haven't sought to introduce such radical change yet, but do you think you will do it in your own way, on your own terms?
So I think, I kind of know what I think we need to do. We've probably been slower in doing it because we can't, getting distracted, but actually I do think that, you know, the new circumstances following this COVID crisis will accelerate that change. So I'm glad that we know what we need to do, and when I say that, I kind of, it means using the people we have more effectively. We have quite a dispersed functional model in Warwick, which means that we have pockets of people all over the place who supposedly have the same skill set. And not only do they not form an effective community of practice, but we don't seem to have any flexibility about how we deploy them. So, you know, so each little pocket says, oh, we need more resource, we need more resource. And actually, we don't know in many ways how much resource we have or how many people we have with that particular skill set. So I've been kind of wanting to do that mapping exercise for ages. Well, there's lots of stuff I want to do, but I think actually now we do have the momentum to do it and to do it quite well.
Because I mean, because the current crisis actually, you know, is going to require every university to make, you know, significant savings of one kind or another. But it does provide a spur to that kind of organizational redesign to cope with what is actually going to be a very different operating environment for lots of us in professional services.
Yeah, exactly. And we've been having quite a lot of conversations about kind of the messaging, because, you know, what we don't want to do is get people really scared, and we don't want to say this is a crisis, because actually it is manageable, or it should be manageable. You know, it's going to involve some hardships, and we've got big savings targets, but, you know, it is manageable. We should be able to do it. Having said that, you know, I do want it to act as a spur to kind of to make greater change. So, I mean, we're kind of talking about it in all kind of angles, because part of the conversation which had kind of sparked up the PSG reform was people talking about how frustrated they felt by the current models and the current systems, because everybody is working really, really, really hard. But we have very complicated processes. We don't make life easy for ourselves. So they have very little headspace about how to think about how they could do things differently, which does lead to frustrations, because people know when things are being inefficient. So I think there is a desire to change. So just always trying to find that that time and headspace to do it. So I think that will kind of very much play into it. Plus the fact that, you know, another emphasis is the quality of service. So because we've made life very complicated for ourselves, and all our processes, you know, have little bells and whistles and trinkets on them, it can take a long time for stuff to get done, which again is very frustrating. So which isn't a good, it's not a good experience for anybody. It's not a good excuse for the end user. It's not a good for the, you know, person who's part of the process. It's not anybody. So again, it's trying to actually make them better and better quality, but simpler and using fewer steps.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And of course, what we will, you know, we will also be doing things which are different, because I mean, if, you know, you're like us and kind of trying to plan and prepare for what, you know, the next academic session is going to be like, we don't quite know. We just know lots of things are going to be different, and we're going to try and do it safely for everyone. But we're going to have some staff who will still be, you know, working remotely more than they've ever done, and we're going to have fewer staff in the university, and also we're going to be trying to support students in all sorts of different ways as they engage in different ways with their studies and their support services. So everyone, as you say, is going to have to work differently, aren't they?
Yeah, I think they are. And so part of me kind of embraces it, because actually a much more kind of blended learning experience is, I think, the way that we were going to be headed anyway. But again, this has just kind of accelerated that hugely. And, you know, we have probably done about, you know, a change which otherwise would have taken us at least 2 years probably to have done, and we've kind of like done it in 2 months, which has been absolutely incredible to watch. And then there's some that I kind of regret, because actually, you know, I must say I really quite liked my kind of life and my working life. And, you know, even though I am a fan of working from home, because I find it does give me headspace to do stuff rather than being kind of bounced from one meeting to the next, I miss the company, and I kind of miss bumping into people, and I miss those kind of corridor conversations where you learn so much. I miss all of that kind of stuff. So I have very mixed feelings about it. And with all of these things, I think it probably is that kind of mixed economy. So we don't need everybody in the office all the time, you know, and it's certainly for us being a campus university, it's not good for, you know, our air, clean air, you know, sustainability, all that kind of stuff, which is probably why people's fixation is with car parking. fixated, absolutely fixated.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
But so kind of, you know, hopefully it will kind of be a good balance of all of that. But I, you know, I for one would not be wanting us to go completely for working from home, everybody forever, because, you know, it can be much more difficult to get stuff done, I think.
I know, I absolutely agree. But working out that new model is going to be quite challenging, I think, to recognise the need of people to interact, but also the need to recognise that actually that you can do things more efficiently and effectively with a kind of split operation for individuals and teams as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, being forced into this position actually makes us realize that some things are possible that we'd always thought weren't, or that we never wanted to contemplate. But it does, you know, give you a new perspective on things, I think.
Yeah, it does. I mean, so one of the, you know, the great things has been having our kind of our council meeting online, which, you know, because normally, you know, they come up, they kind of, we have a strategy session the night before, we all have a very pleasant dinner. And then we have a kind of, you know, a full morning. And actually, it was fine online. So I think we will be going back to a mix, you know, once there is any kind of new normal.
Yeah.
We're going back to a mix of those things. But I don't think we will be dragging council members up to Warwick and insisting that they have to come up to Warwick each time.
No, I think that's absolutely right, Rachel. And but nevertheless, that. There is still a really, really important part of that, you know, the dinner bit and the social and the, you know, just the informal interactions, both between council members and also with members of the university community, and also a kind of reminder about what a university is. So, but I think you're right, it will be a mix, which will actually be beneficial. But you can't dispense with those on-campus opportunities altogether, because otherwise you lose something essential, I think, from what it means to be a member of a governing body of a university.
Yeah, no, I think so too. I think it's way too easy to become kind of remote from it. And you kind of miss the essence of the place as well. You know, and, you know, it is very much about, you know, there is a very strong Warwick community, which has been, you know, really enhanced, I think, during this pandemic, you know, and, you know, it took a battering last year during the group chat. So, you know, there's been some good kind of coming out of this, and it has reinforced that sense of community. But you can't be a digital community forever.
Yeah. No, absolutely right. I was going to take you back a bit to the kind of start of the lockdown period. And I mean, you mentioned that you had the group chat crisis a year or so ago. And, you know, that was a kind of challenge to the university to respond to, you know, a pressured set of circumstances.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned the community coming together. I mean, you know, it seems to me that lots of universities, communities really did come together at short notice around the, you know, kind of shutting things down and moving everything online, moving off campus, etc.
Yeah.
Was there a really kind of strong sense of a rapid positive response to a crisis at the university then?
Yeah, no, totally. I was very, very, very impressed by how everybody just realised what needed to be done and they just got on with it. And you didn't have any moaning, any complaints, people totally and utterly stoical about it. We made it very clear from the outset that staff were encouraged to go and volunteer and help where they could. And even if they were working, they should take time out and go and do it and not feel guilty about it. And for those staff that were being furloughed, you know, they shouldn't feel bad about being furloughed. And if they wanted, they should use it to go and help their local communities.
Yeah.
And I think that message went down really well with staff, because actually it kind of rang true with what they wanted to do, and actually being given a blessing to do it, I think did assuage what, you know, they might otherwise have felt guilty about. And of course, you know, and this is true of your university and it's true of loads of others as well, you know, our kind of scientists have really kind of, you know, come to the fore, and, you know, we've been kind of making lab space available to our local NHS and doing whatever we can to help, you know, the kind of the national mood. And I think that has, you know, kind of helped reestablish the kind of that essence of what universities are there for which, you know, has been eroded certainly since I've come into the sector. I mean, it's just been constantly bashed. And I was used to the civil service being bashed, but, you know, this feels even more, or has felt even more on a daily basis. But actually, so I kind of would like to hope that nationally it's helping the role of experts to be reasserted again, because, again, you know, they were kind of taking a bashing before this as well. How dare you speak the truth and rely on evidence and that kind of stuff, you know, when you can just put a tweet on social media. But,
No, I think that's absolutely right, Rachel. Because I mean, yeah, there weren't many spots for scientists on the Today programme before, but now, you know, they're on it all the time. Of course, that does expose you to bashing as well, particularly when people have different views. But I think overall, because of all the contributions that you described earlier that universities are making to the response, be it, you know, looking for vaccines or helping with testing or working alongside clinical colleagues, all of those things, and the contribution that, you know, medical and nursing and other health professional students are making as well to the cause, you know, is you know, must be having a positive impression of what universities are seen as in the public eye, and it must be doing this, because after years of taking a hammering, you're absolutely right. Will it be sustained though? I don't know, because it feels at the moment that there isn't a lot of love coming from the government directly, particularly financially. For universities. I mean, you mentioned austerity earlier. I mean, there is very much a view that we were protected from the austerity that other public services had, and that we're still, you know, kind of flush with money, and that we don't need the help that other sectors need. And that's a really difficult obstacle for us to get over at the moment.
Yeah, it is. And we're not very good at getting that kind of point of view. And it has to be said, I have to confess that, you know, because I had responsibility for FE colleges who really, really have taken a massive financial battering through austerity measures. But, you know, and they were, because there were three big pots of money in the department. So one was FE, one was HE, and one was research and science. And research and science were kind of protected. So it didn't mean that, because it was what we call flat cash, so it didn't kind of go up with inflation. So they did take, you know, some kind of loss, but their headline figure stayed fairly the same. HE, of course, there was the kind of the wheeze of the student loans. So that was the kind of seen as the panacea to that. And so every time Treasury would come back in the spending review, the big pot that was left was FE. And it was pretty much drained dry during the kind of the 10 years. I think, well, maybe like 8 years, whatever, post-austerity. So I do think that HE is seen in government as having got off fairly easily. And it's kind of funny, because having come into it, now I can see that actually, you know, it's not very, you know, it is quite austere. I mean, you know, we can be very mean about all sorts of things, probably even meaner than we were in government. But of course, what people don't really see is that kind of investment, and what I don't think they do is they don't look holistically at what it is they have created. So they have created this sense of entitlement in students, which came out of the loans. They have made them consumers, which was actually a completely legal, tangential, unintended consequence. It wasn't part of the thinking, but we happened to get caught up by the legislation. So you've got this thing where students are feeling more entitled. I'm paying you all of this money for some kind of service. You then have the current schism between research and teaching. I'm not paying for that old shabby building. So universities are quickly trying to upgrade all their facilities to provide the level of service that is expected. And then all sorts of expectations are coming on, which were never there before, about, you know, the well-being and looking after and supporting, all of which are really good things, but weren't there particularly previously, I don't think. And students are coming with different issues probably than before. And so they're investing all of that money, but kind of running to keep up. And the dialogue isn't people seeing the investing. It's kind of like, you know, they're being really vainglorious reflecting their glory through these buildings, even though the buildings are there for students, and also to cope with the fact there are far more students than there were before, which is another mix factor not kind of being thrown into the mix. And of course, the quiet thing is the kind of the lack of the withdrawal of any capital from the government, the fact that they used to do it. And that's just a story that never gets told. So, and you know, one of my criticisms, I think, of the sector is, though it's very hard to do, is we just don't tell our story very well. So it's not out there. I know it through private conversations because people have talked to me about it. But, and I don't think we're very good at doing that kind of joined up, holistic.
I think that's absolutely right. And even if we get the odd good story out there, it's the consistent messaging over time to an ever-changing cast of politicians and senior civil servants. Yeah. You've just got to sustain it, and as well as the public mood as well. But yeah, we've never invested enough in that kind of the energy that is required to get that positive picture of what we actually do, but also how difficult it is to sustain that level of investment when, as you say, the capital keeps being taken away. We're in the position where, international fee income, props up an awful lot of activity in university. Yeah. And that's about to, the bottom is about to completely fall out of that, that income stream. And, we are facing, a massive, massive financial hole. This autumn, it might be really bad, or it might be really, really, really bad.
Yeah.
The like of which we will never have seen before. I mean, it worries me that there are still large pockets of people in our universities around the country who, either just deny that that's actually going to happen, or if they do accept it's going to happen, they believe that somehow someone somewhere is going to come up with a load of cash to make it better. But neither of those two things are true.
Well, I don't think they're true either. And even if they did come up with a load of cash, I think the price to be paid in the long run would be very heavy. And of course, this is part of the problem about being treated as a sector. So any cash, which is a kind of general sector-wide scheme, is going to come with huge amounts of extra regulation. I mean, the amount of regulation that has come in since I've been in the sector has been very kind of swift. I haven't been surprised by it, having been in the department, but it certainly has been swift, and it's going to come a lot. So, basically, I think the price to be paid will be institutional autonomy. And the problem is, once one university starts accepting that, then probably all the rest of us, even if we're not intending to take any money from them, are going to be treated in the same way. So, again, they've created this kind of marketplace, this kind of competition, but actually they don't really treat us as a marketplace. They kind of treat us all as one. So again, very kind of mixed thinking, muddle-headed thinking within government about it as well.
So if you imagine, a kind of few years down the line, then do you think that the sector will look very different? Do you think you'll have a bunch of highly regulated institutions in hock to government and a bunch of more free floating, more autonomous institutions? Or do you think we'll all be in the heavily regulated bracket, whether we like it or not, and there will be fewer of us because there'll be enforced mergers? What's your view of the future of the sector?
So I think it would be very hard for them to regulate some and not regulate others. I mean, they could do, earned autonomy, and it could be done on a risk-based approach. But they've been using risk-based approach language ever since OFS was created, and I haven't seen one instance of a risk-based approach. I haven't heard it, but, they just treat everybody the same. Doesn't seem to be any credit given for, good performance or anything like that. So I just don't know how they would operate that. So I think the regulation is going to be for everybody. I think there probably will be fewer, because there seems to be a fairly wide spread acceptance that there are too many. I think certainly FE is going to have a resurgence, and I think that kind of overlap towards the more vocational end of the HE market and FE, I expect to see quite a lot of mergers there. I mean, the mergers question is quite interesting, because you can do things by merger or you can do things by clear pathways. And the T-levels introduction of those is supposed to be trying to introduce a kind of a clearer pathway, which is something I talked a lot about when I was in government. But mergers, well, they can save a bit of money, but they also can be very expensive. I mean, having been in a department which had bits chopped off and then bits merged and then other bits splattered on, I mean, the management time and energy and distraction of that is quite a high cost for quite a number of years. And, you know, whether there's really that much efficiency to be gained, you know, in back office, I'm not sure there is a huge amount. And again, there will be kind of, you know, strategic regional decisions to be made as well, because, you know, I'm absolutely sure that there are some universities, you know, which they just can't allow to fail because they're too much of an economic anchor in certain areas. So I just think the politics of that are such that they won't be allowed to fail no matter what the rhetoric is about it.
So any positive aspects of that future landscape that you would say might actually be worth looking forward to?
Well, I do wonder whether it is going to make them sit back and think about what they have created, whether it really works.
You mean the whole market and consumerism and competition agenda?
The whole market and consumer, and also the whole you know, dependency on international students as well. So it's not that I don't think it's, you know, it's a great thing having many international students, but I think some people might wonder whether it's gone a bit too far. I just think that this crisis has actually shown up quite a lot of the kind of policy challenges in the way that they're kind of thinking about it. And also I think there probably will be more emphasis, because obviously there's going to be I'm expecting there to be a very big push on skills and retraining adults in the workplace, which is something that the previous couple of governments have just weren't interested in at all, and all the money for that was stripped out. But I think there may well be more investment in that, which would be good, and there's an opportunity for universities. And I think there is going to be more of an orientation towards the kind of the more vocational technical skills, which is also good, because actually we need those in the economy and we don't have them, so we've been importing them. And with Brexit, of course, which, you know, I love that cartoon of the couple sitting down saying, "Oh, I wish they'd start talking about Brexit again," or whatever it was.
Rachel, we need to stop there. We've got some very big clouds, but a few silver linings which you've identified. But listen, thank you very much indeed for the conversation. That was absolutely thrilling. I really enjoyed that, and it was really good to talk.
That's all then from University Registrars talking about stuff this time. There'll be plenty more along in due course, and if you can't wait, then please do check out the Registrarism blog on wonky.com, where you'll find lots of higher education comment and fun and games. Until next time.